This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The Supreme Court's, well, two rulings, two of the most important workers' rights cases in its history. One, Harris versus Quinn, and Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby Stores. With us to discuss the Harris ruling is Nicole Berna, SEIU, Service Employees International Union Associate General Counsel, and we're joined by Richard Blum with the Employment Law Project of the Legal Aid Society to discuss the holding in the Hobby Lobby case. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, I'm trying to withhold my own angst and pain. Well, I guess I'm not doing that very well,
no,
am I?
Why should you?
But why don't you tell us precisely, Nicole, what the nature of the case is and how you understand the ruling in Harris versus Quinn?
Well, Harris versus Quinn is a case that was brought by the really radical right-wing anti-worker group, the National Right to Work Foundation, against a group of home care workers and their union, home care workers in the state of Illinois and their union and the state of Illinois. And this case is really part of the broader concerted attack on working people and women in this country. Of course, the vast majority of workers in this field are women, and it is the fastest growing occupation in America. What the Right to Work Foundation was asking the court to do in this case was to overrule a decades-old precedent in a case called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And in that case, the court had ruled that a government employer can require public service workers, like home care workers in this case, to pay a fair share fee, a fee that is the cost that the union incurs when the union negotiates on behalf of workers for better working conditions. Now, the good thing about the decision today is the court, the majority, the very conservative majority of the court, in a decision penned by Justice Alito, who also authored the 5-4 majority in the Hobby Lobby case today, declined the invitation of the Right to Work Foundation to issue a really radical, sweeping ruling and overrule Abood. But instead, what Justice Alito did is really quite insidious. He carved out an exception to this case for these home care workers. And he said, well, these home care workers, they're not really like other workers that provide public sector services. And so these workers and their union don't deserve the protections of the Abood case. And their union and these workers should not be able to charge a fee for the services that they provide to all of the workers in the union. And so while the ruling leaves intact, we are heartened to know that the ruling leaves intact the right of public sector workers to bargain collectively and negotiate fair share fees. And in fact, it also leaves intact the right of these home care workers to form a union. What it really does is weaken these home care workers in Illinois, about 27,000 of them. It weakens their union and will make it much more difficult for them to provide quality care for the people that they serve and to negotiate a strong collective bargaining agreement with the state.
Nicole, could you expand upon the nature of the home care workers union and what the home care workers do and what the exception is and whether that can be exported to other workers in other parts of the country?
Certainly. These home care workers are provide home care to people with disabilities and the frail elderly in the state of Illinois who are Medicaid recipients. And what the work that the home care workers provide really allows people to remain in their homes and live in dignity in their homes rather than being forced into institutionalized care, into the setting of a nursing home where they would otherwise be forced to live were they unable to have a care provider in their home. So this program that provides for individuals with disabilities and the frail elderly to stay in their homes is not only a program that is much really loved by the disability rights community because it does allow people to live with dignity in their homes. It's also a great program for the state. The state of Illinois itself saves around $600 million a year through this program because individuals are remaining in their homes rather than being forced into institutions. And then, as I mentioned, individuals are able to remain in their homes and live in dignity. And so the work that's provided is, of course, assistance with the basic functions of daily living, bathing, eating, cooking, cleaning, taking medications, really the incredibly hard work that is needed by individuals who are, as I mentioned, in recipients of Medicaid and unable to perform these tasks of daily living themselves.
Now, I will come back and parse this out and get a sense of what the spillover effect and what it really means for actually the bread and butter, the survival of public sector unions, even though a boat hasn't been overturned at this juncture. But let's turn our attention to Hobby Lobby. Ricky, tell us somewhat of the ruling in this case, which has a broad swath of things, ruling that closely held corporations, of course, not only have the right to speech now, but they have the right to religious opinions and positions, which they then can impose on their employees?
Well, that's right. I mean, what's ironic here is that Congress passed this act, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, precisely because the Supreme Court was not respecting the religious practices, religious beliefs of workers. There was a case in which a Native American was denied unemployment assistance, unemployment insurance, because he had been fired for using peyote in a religious ceremony. And the court said, well, this is a generally applicable law, so who cares if it was religious, notwithstanding the Constitution. And so Congress said, well, actually, we care, and passed this law to protect workers from that kind of abuse or denial of their religious freedom. The court has now taken that. I mean, they acknowledge this is the origin of this statute, and they've taken this statute and now turned it around to mean that it protects a non-human person, a for-profit corporation, in imposing religious beliefs on workers, who, by denying them access to contraception that is consistent with their own religious beliefs about when life begins and what their needs are, and instead imposes the beliefs of the people behind the corporation, who I would imagine come tax time come time to defend themselves in a Title VII lawsuit for any other kind of discrimination, would say, well, gee, we're not the employer, it's really the corporation, right, because we're totally separate. And here the court sort of laughs at that distinction, which is, you know, exactly why corporations exist, is to protect the people behind them from liability, and says, well, you know, really a corporation's only just the people behind it. So there's a lot of hypocrisy in this decision, and it's scary because it means that it takes away precisely the kinds of protections that this Religious Freedom Restoration Act was designed to reinstate after the Supreme Court onslaught in that case about Native Americans.
Are there other, in the ruling itself, is there any opening for other kinds of issues that these corporations believe in that they can impose upon employees? Does it have legs in that way?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, religion is, of course, a particularly protected area, but it sort of opens up an entire question that, you know, apparently these non-human persons, for-profit corporations, have the full panoply of rights that, you know, biological real humans have. But not only that, they apparently now have even more rights than actual real people when they are the employer.
I just want to go back to Harris. And Ricky, you should chime in. I know you thought you had some questions for Nicole as well. But we have now carved out this exception, really, for home care workers, who are one of the fastest growing efforts to unionize and to bring home care workers. And this has implication, I think, for domestic workers and so on, into the house of organized labor. What does it really mean for the spread of that to other areas in other states, and how, in essence, really, can a union survive without these fees that are being charged for the services that are being provided?
Well, Mimi, the case itself really only applies to the facts at issue in the Illinois home care system. The court examines at length the details of that system and finds that these workers are different from other public sector workers and therefore shouldn't receive the protections of this 40-year-old Supreme Court precedent. The court does not weigh in on other models in other states or other kinds of workers, but what the decision really does is ignore the changing nature of the American workforce, that more and more workers are working at locations remote from a large office or building, office building. More and more workers are engaging in part-time work, in contingent work, and this is true in the public sector and the private sector as well. And this workforce is indeed among the fastest growing and the most needed in America. More than 10,000 Americans turn 65 every day, and it's said that the number of senior citizens will double by 2050. And so we're really facing this huge need for home care workers, and this system that was developed by the state of Illinois and enacted by the Illinois legislature was a system that was put into place in order to provide care for these individuals and allow them to stay in their homes and, as I mentioned, also save money to the state. Without a system, a functioning system of collective bargaining and an administering of a collective bargaining contract, it will be much more difficult for states to administer programs such as this and for individuals, the elderly individuals and people with disability, to be able to remain in their homes.
What was the nature of the exception to the general rule that the Supreme Court made so that these workers do not have to pay fees if they don't want to? And isn't it likely, or do you think it's likely, that the National Right to Work Foundation or other right room groups will bring court cases in other jurisdictions for other types of workers that they say fit into this exception?
Well, unfortunately, the National Right to Work Foundation has already brought a number of cases against workers such as these who they claim don't follow the traditional model of a public sector worker. But they haven't stopped there. The National Right to Work Foundation has also brought a straight-up challenge to the rights of public sector workers to bargain collectively in a case called Friedrich versus the California Teachers Association that's pending now in the Ninth Circuit. The Right to Work Foundation is really seeking to overrule the precedent in Abood, and that case is certainly likely to wind its way up through the courts, and I think is that straight-up challenge. And so those cases are already out there. They are pending, and they certainly present a threat that I think Justice Alito, if he were able to garner a 5-justice majority, would have so ruled in this case today. Clearly, he was unable to get a 5-vote majority for that, and so the ruling is more narrow, applying only to these home care workers rather than to all public service workers. And the kinds of distinctions that he makes are really, I think, as Justice Kagan points out in her very well-reasoned dissent, really distinctions without a difference. She rightly says that these workers are really could be the poster child for the need for public sector collective bargaining. Of course, these workers are scattered about in 27,000 workers in 27,000 different workplaces. And so through the union, they're able to unite with a collective voice and bargain collectively. Without the union, they're simply just that, workers scattered about the state, unable to unite with a collective voice to bargain with the state for raises in their wages or other improvements to their working conditions. They really have. It's remarkable what the workers in Illinois have achieved through this collective bargaining model. These workers began 20 years ago organizing, and they were paid as little as $3 an hour at that time. And they will soon be, by the end of this year, at $13 an hour. So they've been able to achieve many different improvements in their working conditions, as have home care workers, hundreds of thousands of home care workers in the other states where home care workers have a union throughout the country as well.
Well, we see a case like Harris versus Quinn that was essentially funded by ultra-right-wing organizations, groups like the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, who has no intention of stopping here. And, of course, we see the court really analyzing the First Amendment in a way that really further entrenches the notion that domestic work is not real work. We're going back now again to look at Hobby Lobby. And there, Ricky, the decision means that employees in those companies, and this was a craft grouping of craft shops throughout the country. It's not a small individual, not-for-profit entity. It is a large corporate, closely held, although corporation. And there the decision means that the employees of those companies will have to obtain forms of birth control from other sources. So isn't this an attack also on reproductive freedom for women? And similarly, doesn't it have enormous and frightening implications for who gets to determine discrimination within the context of the workforce merely by virtue of claiming that this corporation has a religious right that is being presumably offended?
Well, yes and yes.
Thanks. I was hoping you were going to say no.
That was the shortest answer we've had so far. Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm dismissed. It is very frightening in its potential scope. The ability to invoke, religion to justify all sorts of pernicious conduct is something that we have a long history of in this country. I mean, we shouldn't forget that slavery was justified as part of a religious order, and that pretty much every kind of systemic, form of racism since has been justified by somebody as, a necessary part of a religious order. As a queer activist, obviously, I have a particular acute awareness of this, of the invocation of religion to deny whole swaths of people their rights. And, of course, employers have tremendous power over other people. And in this case, it's, as you've pointed out, I mean, this is nothing small. This is not like, somebody, running their one-person business and with one employee or something like that. The whole point of having a corporate structure is that you can expand and that you don't face liability and you get all sorts of advantages, and nobody makes you do that. You could run something as just yourself, as a sole proprietor, if you really want to express your personal religious views. But even there are constraints on what you can do as an employer, as there should be under the law. And it's really scary to think that that's now being, it's both insulating bigotry and insulating and giving that power to, to large employers. And, this idea that a for-profit fictional person gets to impose some sort of, religious order on its employees is a scary direction to go in.
Well, these are both really insidious attacks on certainly women, on reproductive rights, on really the liberation or the liberatory character of the First Amendment. Instead, that becomes using the First Amendment, using religion as a way of restricting clearly other people's rights, and certainly restricting rights in the workplace and the rights of labor to come together and to bargain for its collective need.
And Mimi, if I could say one word about Harris versus Quinn, even though I was not involved in it. You would be forgiven if you read through the decision and couldn't figure out really what the First Amendment interest being invoked was. They sort of belittle the role of the union in protecting workers, and yet there are these enormous gains that workers have made thanks to unionization in these states. And they just poo-poo that and pretend it didn't happen. At the same time, they keep insisting that there's this profound First Amendment interest involved, and it's sort of hard to figure out exactly what the First Amendment interest is in not paying for a service you're being provided.
Well, in the 30 seconds so that we have left, Nicole, what is there to take heart. Similarly, Ricky, if there isn't, so be it. But certainly people of goodwill and activists refuse to be daunted by even these most awful of decisions. And a court that has long been the most conservative wing, really, of the government structure. Nicole, what do we do?
Well, here at SEIU and for home care workers around the country, I know that there's no court case is going to stand in the way of these workers coming together to have a strong voice for quality care and good jobs. These workers are more determined than ever because of this case to join together, and they know that unions are the best way to do that. They are working in partnership with states and consumer groups, disability rights groups, groups that advocate for the elderly, really to ensure that home care workers continue to have a strong voice for quality home care and for good jobs. And that will continue. That won't stop. They had a strong voice, and they gathered together before they had a union and before they were recognized by the state, and they will continue as well after Harris v. Quinn.
Ricky Blum?
Single payer. when it comes to health care, it doesn't stop the basic problem of allowing religious discrimination against workers, but when it comes to health care, we need to have a single-payer system that honors people's reproductive choices, it honors people's sexual lives and sexual freedom and autonomy, and we shouldn't put it in the hands of employers.
Well, thanks to both Nicole, who has been with us through this case for some time now, Nicole Berna, SEIU Associate General Counsel, and to Ricky Blum with the Employment Law Project of the Legal Aid Society, and certainly the struggle will continue on the many fronts and imperatives that are raised by these two cases. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We now go to a demonstration in Columbus, Ohio, protesting the Hobby Lobby case.
My name is Eris. I'm from Cleveland. And we are here, I am here, because everybody should have access to whatever it is that they need to have access to, no matter what.
Because as a person of faith, I have a real problem with healthcare providers using the excuse of religious freedom to put their personal decisions in my healthcare.
Not this!
Birth control!
Not this!
Birth control!
I'm here today because birth control is important. It's not up to your boss. I have two younger sisters and hope that their access to birth control will not be impeded by a boss that disagrees with that. Healthcare is not up to your boss.
Not my boss is good as this. Not my boss.
Really good health insurance, and I'm really lucky that I don't have to. My health insurance doesn't depend on what my bosses think, and it shouldn't be a matter of lucky or I have a great boss or my boss doesn't care about that stuff. That should be something that nobody should worry about when they take a job if their health insurance is going to cover things like birth control. That's ridiculous to me. So that's why I'm here.
Not my boss's business! Not my boss's business!
Yeah. I'm here today because I'm here to protest the Hobby Lobby case. I think all women should be able to have access to affordable health care and coverage to all birth control.
I came down from Cleveland to Columbus to call attention to the backwards politics because I absolutely support the right to birth control and reproductive health and the availability of health care, all of it, to everyone.
The biggest thing of all.
Keep your lobby out my lobby. Keep your lobby out my lobby.
I'm here from Cleveland all the way to Columbus to show my support for Planned Parenthood, to show my support for women everywhere, and because corporations are not people, women are people.
Birth control! Always!
I came out to support my rights and rights of women in Ohio and all across the country to have access to birth control, which we all need.
Control!
When do we want it?
Always!
What do we want?
Because I'm fortunate enough to have a health care coverage that offers me contraception, and it actually offers me free contraception. And there's a lot of people out there who could really use that. And I just want to make sure that everyone has access to free contraception in their health care plan.
Birth control matters.
Davis, I came today because I've supported Planned Parenthood a long time. I really believe in a woman's right for reproductive health and abortion and safe birth control. And I think that no lawmaker has the right to take that away.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.